Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, what local pro-wrestling circuits reveal about the human experience.
They become a character, and the world gets very small. It shrinks to the size of the ring.
Then, a Winterville exhibit reveals a little-known side of music icon John Lennon. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. In her new book, local author Allison Lynn Miller explores a little-known side of Northeast Georgia, its professional wrestling circuit. Part sport and part theater, it turns out that this activity reveals something much deeper about the human spirit. Miller sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss her nonfiction book, Rough House, A Father, A Son, and the Pursuit of Pro Wrestling Glory, published this year by Norton. Here's their conversation.
Would you mind giving us an overview of your book, Rough House, A Father, A Son, and the Pursuit of Pro Wrestling Glory?
Sure. Yeah, the book is a product of my 5 years kind of entrenched with the local professional wrestling scene here in Georgia. And this is professional wrestling on what I call the lowest rung of a long ladder to the top, and the top being WWE and AEW, the two major wrestling companies in the world today. So these are kind of community-focused professional wrestling shows that take place at venues, ranging from a VFW to a Boys and Girls Club.
And what motivated you to immerse yourself in this world?
I went to a wrestling show here in Athens in February of 2019. It was something that I had just heard about and thought would be fun, something fun to do on a Saturday night. And I stood there that night, and I could just sense the connection between the fans and the performers. And it was kind of unlike a sporting event and unlike a theater event. It kind of straddled the line in that I sensed that the crowd had agency over the ring. So that means that when a wrestler is down, kind of getting thrown into the corner and beat up, the crowd is actually what compels him up. And I thought there was something pretty magical in that.
Can you tell us a little bit about what professional wrestling looks like in the ring for people who don't watch it?
Yeah. So it's like I mentioned before, it's kind of this amalgamation of theater and sport. It is predetermined, meaning that the wrestlers know ahead of time who's going to win. And they may have rehearsed a couple of the moves before they get into the ring, but it is not entirely scripted. So the cool thing about being a wrestler is that you have to go into the ring with enough knowledge and experience to be able to kind of ad lib as you go, right? There's a lot of improvisation. So they have, hundreds of different types of moves that they've practiced and that they know about. And they use those to kind of tell stories in the ring. And there is actually a lot of thought that goes into it. And they have to do all this without getting severely injured.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of pro wrestling in America?
Yeah, so it stems from the carnival, actually. So kind of turn of the century, meaning, 1800s to early 1900s. Wrestling, the type of wrestling that you would see in the Olympics used to be really popular. And they would put on these shows in the carnival. And because these shows were not scripted, they would go on forever. I mean, it was literally, it took forever for someone to win. And the planners of these shows could see that the crowd was kind of getting weary. So then they started, what I call in the book, playing God. They would kind of get in the ear of these fighters and encourage one or the other to kind of end it. And, both fighters would have to be to agree to that. And so out of that was born kind of even more directing into their performance. And from there, it went to kind of these exaggerated moves. So the reason that it's so loud in the ring is the ring itself, the materials that it's made of, but also wrestlers stamp their feet when they throw a punch. They do things to kind of amplify the sound. And so it became more of a show, and it was much more exciting to spectators, and that's still the case.
Can you tell us a little bit about the sort of main character in the book, Hunter James? How did you discover him?
Yeah, the opening scene of the book takes place in the fall of 2019, which was the beginning of my reporting. It takes place in the backyard of another wrestler's house, and he has a ring there where he trains wrestlers. I met Hunter that night. He was a few days shy of his 17th birthday, and he just made the ideal central character to kind of take people in and out of these spaces in this scene.
So you have graciously agreed to read a couple passages from your book. And I think I picked these passages out because they kind of show what Hunter James is going through as it sets the book up. His family wants him to go to college, and he is grappling with either going to college or pursuing his dream to be a pro wrestler. Would you mind reading these two passages?
Sure. He'd done the research. He knew college didn't guarantee a higher income. Besides, college-educated people sometimes acted like they were better than him. He didn't want to be around it, didn't want to waste his time, wasn't going to spend one more second doing anything besides the thing he loves. At 18, Hunter doesn't understand the stakes. He can't feel the ache of inevitability his father feels. He doesn't see the wrestlers all around him who started with the same goal. Men with swollen, broken bodies who continue to show up because the fleeting stardom is a lifeline, a ticket out without having to go anywhere.
So I would love for you to tell us a little bit more about these passages and how they set the story up.
Hunter's father, he also pursued professional wrestling as a young person, and he did it for over a decade until he realized that he wasn't going to make it to the big time. And he was starting a family with his wife, and he saw the writing on the wall. And for him, he didn't want to be, it was the top or nothing for him. So that's why he stopped. And then he kind of vowed that he would not allow his boys to pursue that dream because it had left him, you know, he had dropped out of high school. He never went to college, you know, and he spent his life, you know, at various kind of wage working jobs and manufacturing centers and whatnot. And he wanted something better for Hunter and his younger brother. But he also knew that if Hunter stepped through the curtain and went into the ring, that there would be no turning back. So in a way, he knew that Hunter would someday pursue it because it was this thing that had really brought them together over the years. And Hunter, as a child, had spent so many nights watching his dad in the ring. But like I said, Billy Ray knew that the moment he went through that curtain, it was going to be all over. So he was doing his best to kind of slow that down. Well, Hunter wasn't going to have that. I don't want to give away the book, but yeah, basically he decides to go full speed ahead on his dream of being a pro wrestler, and he hasn't looked back.
What does this story of this family suggest about the political and social moment that we're in?
Well, I think a couple of things. For one, it's really hard to make it in America, making a living and supporting a family on an hourly job. And, you know, all of or nearly all of the wrestlers that I encountered in this world are doing that work. So wrestling for those people, I read it's a ticket out without having to go anywhere. It's a chance for them to kind of be something other than who they are from 9 to 5 or for whatever hours that they work. When they show up in the ring and they pull up their gear, they become a character, and the world gets very small. It shrinks to the size of the ring. So it doesn't matter where they came from. It doesn't matter what they're going to go home to after for those, you know, 6 minutes of their match. You know, they're the biggest thing in the world. So in that way, it's cathartic. And at the same time, the fans around the ring are getting that same kind of emotional sensation in that there's just not that many places in the world where it's acceptable to stand up and yell as loud as you can at someone. And that's encouraged in wrestling. I mean, that's the fans are, you know, crucial to the experience. So it is this kind of place of escapism, which I think is important now more than ever.
Really fascinating. Where can people learn more about your book?
So people can learn about the book at AllisonLynnMiller.com. It's with one L and one N. I'm doing a book tour. I think I've got about 15 cities lined up. So I'll be doing that. There's also an audiobook that you can find on Amazon or wherever you listen to audiobooks. The book is available locally at bookstores and around the country.
Allison Miller, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Lynn Miller is a local author whose book, Rough House, A Father, A Son, and the Pursuit of Pro Wrestling Glory, was published this year by Norton. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
You know exactly how you take your morning coffee. Knowing where to get news you can rely on is just as simple. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. John Lennon was an iconic figure of the 20th century. In the early 70s, he underwent a tumultuous period as he cemented himself as a solo act. He was also in a romantic relationship with May Pang, who had been his assistant. Pang reveals her perspective of this 18-month-long time span in the 2022 documentary, The Lost Weekend, A Love Story. During this interval, Pang captured candid photos of Lennon, which will be on display at the Winterville Cultural Center from February 20th to 22nd. Pang sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss what these photos represent. Here's their conversation.
John Lennon was obviously such an iconic figure of the 20th century, first as a member of the Beatles, as an anti-war activist, and then as a solo artist. You knew him and were his romantic partner in the early 1970s. So I have to ask, from your perspective, what was John Lennon like?
He was a complex man, and yet at the same time, he was very simple. And the man that I knew was just wanted to embrace life and just enjoy it and do things that he had never done. So for me, John was like curious, like we'd be going, he goes, what do you think we should do today? And this was like in the winter of 1974 in New York City. And I said to him, well, you want to know what New York City's about and where, you know, how I lived. And I said, come on, you're going to go on a bus ride with me. He goes, a bus? I said, yeah, we're going to take a ride on the city bus. So I took him on a ride down one of the avenues. And it was I remember that we started out with only a couple of people on the bus. And by the time we hit a certain street, it just started to get packed. And somebody turned around and you could hear the whispering, because that looks like John Lennon on the bus. And then finally somebody was brave enough to say, hey, John, how are you doing? And he said, and he just turned around and answered him, and he goes, I'm fine. He went, I told you. The kid just went wild. I told you it was him. And John turned to me and said, it's time to get off.
That's really a funny moment. And So you produced a documentary that recounts your relationship with John Lennon called The Lost Weekend, A Love Story, which shows this particular period in his life called The Lost Weekend, in both of your lives.
Right.
You were very young during this time in your your early 20s. Why was it important to you to tell the story of The Lost Weekend?
Well, it's important because my life with him was so taken out of context by people and saying they knew what my life, a lot of people really thought that the Lost Weekend, that my time with John was only a weekend. So, I mean, I even have acquaintances of musicians that have said, oh, I saw your movie, and I really didn't know that you were with him that long. So people have an idea of what my relationship was about, but they don't really know. So, and people were telling it, and it sort of got out of hand. And I'm reading about myself, and I said, that's not how it happened. So finally, it finally got to me, and I said, all right, it's time for me to take back my narrative and start to tell the way it really happened. And only I can tell because I'm the only one there.
In the documentary, there is a lot of footage from when you were a guest on talk shows a little bit after that period. Turning to your photography that will be on display in Winterville, how does the photography help you tell the story in a different way as compared to when you were on those talk shows a bit after that period?
Well, you know, those photographs of John are all candid shots when John and I were together. And John used to encourage me to take the photos. And he would just give me carte blanche to take whatever, whenever. And I didn't abuse that. I just used it for when I felt there was a nice composition that I saw and something that I didn't see, you know, in him. For instance, you know, most people take photos of John and it's for their collection. Most photos that are done of John are for either a magazine or something. I took photos of just our home life, which he was always curious to see. And it turned out that he loved a few of the photographs, that he had one of them that he wanted to use as the 45 single sleeve back in the day when I think Imagine was going to be released in the United Kingdom. And he said, I like to use that photo. That's one of my favorite photos that you took. So it was capturing us, different from being paid for as a session and say, let me just take a photo and get a photo session. This is all just us at home. So there's no playing up to for a reason for a camera. You know, it's, if he's playing up to the camera, it's because we're just having fun, not because it was required.
Can you tell us about other photos in the collection that kind of stand out to you?
It's amazing. One of the photos is one of the last photos of John and Paul, which who would have thought that? It's the last photo, but it's not their last time of seeing one another. Paul and Linda used to come over to our apartment in New York.
Can you tell us a little bit about the artistry that you use in your photos? Tell us a little bit about the style.
I think for me, my style was just capturing people and in their moments, whether they'd be thinking something that was about them. They're unusual, you know, I don't want to say unusual. It's not. It's reflective moments or just something that you don't normally see. And I think I captured that. It's like I also, John had to encourage me and he kept prodding me to take photos. And I'm the only one that has a picture of his hand signing mid-signature, on the documents of the breakup, the dissolution of the Beatles. I had no idea. And John's yelling at me going, come and take the photos, come and take the photo. Will you? I mean, anybody else would have jumped at it. I was too busy thinking, is Julian okay? Because this was our Christmas holiday in 1974 and we were down in Florida at Disney World.
Yeah, I think something that really came through in the documentary was your care for Julian. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the photos that you took of John Lennon's son, Julian?
Well, you know, I just thought it was finally something, you know, he was happy. He was happy to see his father. He hadn't seen him in like 3 years. So it was important for me to capture those moments so that, you know, John could remember and Julian could remember. And I'm probably the only one I could think of that I have both a father and son covers. So John took the photo of himself for the 45 sleeve. And Julian, a couple of years ago when he released his album Jude, asked me for photos and that became the album cover, a picture of him when he was around 11 years old. So it's those moments that I wanted to capture of the time. You know, he didn't have much of with his dad, and I thought this would be good. So it's at our apartment, it's when they were swimming, there's still more of the two of them swimming together, and you know, that hasn't been seen. So it's great. I wanted that.
And finally, why have this exhibit now?
And why not? It's like unearthing, you know, I never even thought people would be interested. Actually, it was Scott Siegelbaum who called me up and says, you know, I'd like to see if we can get these photographs and as an exhibition. It's a pop-up, you know, so it's a touring thing. And I said, I don't think people would be interested in my home photos of John. And he said, you'll be surprised. Well, I was surprised. I am surprised. And that many people would love to see these photos of him, because they're like I said, they're more at home. They're not posed for anything but us. But, you know, I just want people to see John as I saw him. You're seeing him through my eyes. So this is the John at home. This is not the John, on stage as the Beatles or John Lennon, you know, the performer. This is John, just John at home.
Well, May Pang, thank you so, so much for your time today.
Thank you.
May Pang's candid photos of iconic musician John Lennon will be on display at the Winterville Cultural Center from February 20th through 22nd. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. This week's show was produced by Emma Auer. If you missed a portion of this broadcast, Athens News Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at WUGA.org, and will be rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. As always, thanks for listening, and stay with WUGA throughout the week for the latest in-depth local news.